Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we present a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled The Digital Preservation Network, and our speaker is James Hilton, Vice President and Chief Information Officer for the University of Virginia.
Thank you. Good morning. So I'm reminded an 8 a.m. featured session is an interesting concept. It reminds me of I taught intro social for summer school one time where the class met from 9 to 12, 4 days a week in the summer. And there were about 150 students in it, and trying to figure out every day how to bring a little energy into the room was a challenge. I'm going to sense a similar challenge here. There's coffee at the exits, I think. So I want to start with just a couple of caveats before I go in, because I think all academic talks start with caveats, hedges, hedge your bets. Your mileage may vary. And so the first one is to acknowledge that I'm going to be talking about digital preservation. And this is a talk that is designed to enroll, motivate, explain sort of at the 50,000-foot level what the problem is. And the minute you talk to people who are deeply involved in digital preservation, you'll be struck by the complexity of the challenge. And nothing about my talk denies the complexity of the challenge, right? These are going to be hard issues we're dealing with. I'm not trying to diminish the challenges of them. But my point is going to be we have to actually move at scale together, or we'll never solve any of the challenges for the long haul. So the first caveat is, I know it's a lot more complicated than it's going to appear as we go through. The second caveat is, before he became an English professor, my father was a Baptist preacher. And if today goes well, this is going to be sort of like a tent revival, right? My favorite course evaluation ever said, what could Professor Hilton do to improve the class? And it said, breathe occasionally, right? So if this works, I'm going to move sort of like a freight train. Online people who are going to have questions are going to ask questions, and our moderator is going to wave me down. You should feel free to interrupt me. If we don't get all the way to the end, that'll be okay. I'll also try to leave time at the end, though, for questions. But if you have a burning question, I would much rather address it while it's burning than wait until the end and you're looking for the exits. Okay? You ready? Okay, well, we're going to start by paying homage to the audacity of libraries and librarians. I have the good pleasure to work with some of the most amazing librarians in the world. I have the good fortune in everything that I'm about to talk about of having Karin Wittenborg, who's the university librarian at UVA, to be my partner. One of the things that I like most about Karin is Karin never met a revolution she didn't like. And so she's a librarian who really likes to shake things up. And libraries are really, you know, I think we think of libraries as staid places. They're the quiet places. They're where you go to try to get away from everything else. But in fact, libraries are enormously audacious. They're audacious in their purpose. Think about it. 1731, open a public library so that people could have access to the printed words. A move, by the way, which the publishers were convinced would end their business. How could we provide more access and not lose business? Interesting, sort of, if you think about Google's model these days, right? So provide access, right? And Carnegie went around, started to fund libraries, built more than 1,000 libraries over the span of about 3 decades in order to bring access to the people. The idea was so that everybody could get to the books in their community. Hundreds and hundreds of libraries open. And in fact, if you look at the top 10 libraries in the world right now and said, well, how many books did they bring into the house? More than 100 million volumes. Audacious to start from, let's open a city library, to a world in which we have hundreds of libraries providing public access and now scanning them and providing them online. But there's another way in which libraries are audacious. It's the audacity of forever. If you think about it, libraries, museums, cultural memory institutions are the only institutions that actually are charged with the challenge of forever. Elsevier's not. Google's not. Right? Only libraries and museums are really concerned with how do we preserve the treasures of today for tomorrow. And they've been doing it for centuries. And they've been doing an amazing job with it. So if you look, you know, I had 2 weeks ago, I got to go through a special collections tour at UVA. We had a donor in, and we went down and we were doing it. And, you know, during the course of that tour, you know, I got to hold Jefferson's original drawing for the rotunda, right? I got to see a manuscript that was signed by the King of Spain in the 15th century. I got to hold a clay tablet that was 2,000 years old. All preserved for scholarship and this generation, right? An amazing job, and amazingly audacious. But there's a problem, right? And here's the problem. Most of the scholarship that's being produced today is being produced digitally. Even the stuff that looks and smells like it's traditional book-like scholarship is produced digitally, right? And that provides two problems. One is, how do we understand what these objects are? So, for example, NINDS is a project, again, run out of the University of Virginia. It's about a decade old now. And it is an online community of 19th century Victorian literary critics. Right? And it's a dynamic website. It's got peer review. It changes moment to moment. And it is the community where that group of scholars come together. And fundamentally, what scholarship is a public communication, right? It's a public dialogue. So how do we preserve that? How good are we at preserving digital things? Or think about data. We'll talk about this more. But the point is that most of the scholarship, if you go to the Wright Humanities conferences these days, half of the conference, at least, is happening on Twitter. Half of the public conversation, half of what, again, I would argue is scholarship, a public conversation between scholars, informed, made public, half of it's happening on Twitter. I don't even know how to think about Twitter yet as a scholarly object, right? But it's where scholarship has moved, right? So how are we at preserving that? How safe are digital works for the long haul? Not 5 years, not 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, the audacity of forever. How safe are they? Well, it's terrible. It's a disaster. It's a train wreck. It's a scandal. Scholarship is moving at a pace into the digital realm that is, as Ralph Nader pointed out about the Chevette, not the Chevette, the Corvair, unsafe at any speed, right? The problem is that the scholarship that's being produced today is at serious risk of being lost forever to future generations. Forever to future generations. And that's true for things that look and smell like books, right? Digital books and journals require different and much more active strategies to maintain it, not to even worry about the legal issues of how you get access to them to begin with. Even if you have legal access to the bits and you can display it, you can migrate it, and you can do all that stuff, it's much harder to preserve bits, right? How many of you have ever had trouble opening an old file? Yeah, Has anybody not ever had trouble opening a new file? Actually, I was on the plane doing the finishing touches on this talk yesterday, and it just disappeared just as we were landing.
Never mind.
So anyway, digital objects are much harder to curate. It's true for books. It's true for emerging scholarship, again, in the humanities, right? Where people talk about the digital humanities, right? We've had conferences, we've had sessions at EDUCAUSE about the digital humanities. So think about it as the digital humanities is a mistake. Because the digital humanities are easily ignored. Digital humanities sounds like this boutique thing, this emerging form of scholarship, maybe it'll catch on. It's not digital humanities now, it's humanities in a digital age. It's already digital. Even the people who are saying we're never going to be digital humanities are already digital. They're just not making other changes. But it's already happened, right? And it's true for data with a vengeance, right? There are two things that we know about data. There's lots we don't know about data, but there are two things that we know about data. The volume of data is growing, and access and preservation requirements are increasing. So currently, NSF, for example, requires data management plans for projects that collect large amounts of data. They're pretty much a Rorschach. You got to have a data management plan. That is surely going to change. The government is not going to be willing to continue to fund research that they can't provide not only access to now, but durable access to future generations. Why are we going to pay to keep repeating the same stuff over and over again? So take, for example, the main detectors at the super collider in Switzerland, the LHC. So it only runs 6 months out of a year because it consumes so much power. But in the 6 months that it's the most expensive scientific instrument ever built, it's built by a consortium of European countries. And in 1 6-month period, it produces 10 to 15 petabytes of data, 3 million DVDs worth of data, right? And easily as much of the figuring out how to move those data, how to reduce those data, how to analyze those data is as large a problem as building the collider probably, right? At some point they still stick things on 747s. Now much of the data that are going to be collected in that tsunami are going to be thrown away. Right? If you are in science and you depend upon replication, it may actually be cheaper to repeat the experiment in some instances than to keep the data. Right? Much of it's going to be thrown away. But some of it you can never lose. So let's take astronomy. So this is an image of Kepler's supernova. Kepler's supernova was the last supernova to occur in our galaxy. It happened we saw it in 1604. It's called Kepler's supernova because Kepler wrote about it and described it, right? It occurred 13,000 light years away in our galaxy. The next closest supernova happens in 1987, optimistically named 1987A, right? Because we might have a B. Right? And it was a mere 163,000 light years away. So, hundreds of years separate these two events. The data that are collected can never be replaced. Right? Astronomical data is like watching history. You can't turn the clock back. You can't go back and say, oh, let's rerun the supernova. We'll catch it, right? So you're catching it a stream at a time. I would submit to you that these data will never be worthless. They will always have value. And so we've got to think about how to keep them, right? Now scholarship, so the point about this is that right now scholarship is being lost because we've actually raced into the digital age. We haven't necessarily even intended to do it. That's the point about digital humanities. Even humanists who aren't interested in being digital humanists are pulled into the digital humanities or humanities in the digital age, whether they want to be or not. So who's going to preserve it? I remember, for a little while, I was the interim university librarian at Michigan. And we had a meeting with some higher-ups from Elsevier, Elsevier is probably the major STEM publisher. They have, it would be safe to say, a near monopolistic control over their market. And so the provost and I and some of the library staff all met with these folks from Elsevier. And we were talking about this problem, about digital preservation. And Elsevier's response was, we got it. Don't worry about it. Right? We were Galileo's publisher. We've been around for hundreds of years. We got it. And Paul Courant looked at them and said, well, here's the problem. You know, we're universities. Even though we in the United States are relatively young universities, we're not impressed by 400 years. We think in terms of centuries. We have the hubris to believe that we actually will be here forever and that our mission is forever. So that's the first thing. So the second thing is, how are you going to explain, okay, you'll take on digital preservation. You'll do it all. How are you going to take that on without a revenue stream behind it? Right? What happens, are you going to go tell your board of directors, we just took on a perpetual liability with no revenue stream behind it? He said, we're universities. We lose money on everything and make it up on the volume. We're used to that problem. Which actually, if you kind of think about it, it's kind of true. We lose money on research. We lose money certainly on in-state students. We lose money on everything. In the aggregate, though, we kind of make it between a combination of philanthropy and a little bit of other things and here and there. So his point is, we're already used to thinking in that nonprofit world, and our mission is to drive it forever. And universities have been around forever. And Michael McRobbie actually made this point when he was talking at when he was giving a keynote address at Internet 2. Universities are the only institutions that are really built. Universities are really the only institutions that are built for the long haul. So, what's the current state of play? Is that clear? Any questions so far? Tough crowd. Okay. So, what's the current state of play? The current state of play is lots of digital collections with a smattering of aggregation. So, we have thousands of digital repositories in the academy right now. Every university that had spare server space and could download a copy of DSpace, put it in. A few universities that had a lot of IT support downloaded Fedora and put it in. Right? They're a little different, but so there are repositories all over the place, right? It's not clear. So I was at Michigan when we spun up our first institutional repository, and it sounded really good at the time. We're going to spin up an institutional repository to make the works of our faculty accessible. Right? Well, that's okay, but actually a lot of it's already accessible because it's published. So where's the repository strategy? Right? We put it in thinking that it was one thing. Where the repository strategy is going to be is actually in durable access, durable preservation. It's how do we make sure we have copies that we can do. But there is a smattering of, there are lots of repositories all over the place with a smattering of aggregation playing out across different content areas, right? And different objects types. So there are rich media repositories, the Shoah Foundation. There are data repositories. Physicists run their own repositories. Astronomers have Sloan Digital Sky, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. Like I said, most institutions have various forms of text repositories, places where you can deposit your works, right? Most of the emphasis, and this is really important, most of the emphasis of those repositories is on providing access. So Sloan Digital Sky Survey is about providing access to astronomical data. The University of Michigan's institutional repository, the University of Virginia's institutional repository are primarily aimed at giving faculty places to put their stuff where others can get to it. It's mostly about access. And there's a hope, there's a promissory nod towards long-term preservation with the understanding that that's really complicated. And the problem is that there are all these repositories and all of them are susceptible to multiple single points of failure. So what kinds of failure am I talking about? Well, there's technology failures. We tend to think of technology failures in our world as, well, did I mention that my computer ate the PowerPoint presentation on final approach yesterday? We tend to think about those technological, but technological failures have been around forever and ever. The Rotunda burned. The Rotunda, right, at the University of Virginia, the Rotunda was the library when the university was founded. It was at the center of the campus. That was sort of one of the things that was distinctive about UVA. It put a library at its center rather than a church at its center, and it burned. Right? Technological failure. Politically related failure. So I don't know how many of you were following during the Arab uprising, the Arab Spring, but the Library at Alexandria, right? The original Library at Alexandria, of course, classic case of lost, right? The Mubarak regime committed to rebuilding the Library of Alexandria, actually with a large emphasis on digital collections. But in the Arab Spring, the Library at Alexandria came to be seen as a symbol of corruption, as a symbol of Western influence, and it was closed for a long period. There were actually very serious doubts, very serious concerns that it was in fact going to be torched. Right? So the point is, no matter where you are, if everything exists in one political, one cultural ecosystem, that too is a single point of failure. With me? Okay. And then the biggest of all, the most common, organizationally related failure. So I've mentioned the Sloan Digital Sky Survey a couple of times. The Sloan Digital Sky Survey is a survey of the night sky. It's been going on for more than a decade. Funded by Sloan. It's been enormously valuable as a scientific resource. The Sloan Digital Sky Survey has mapped more than 930,000 galaxies. It's resulted in more than 2,000 original publications, 70,000 citations. Remember, this is the kind of data that you can't ever go back and get again, right? And so it's been enormously valuable. Related to that, the National Space Telescope. This is the first. Last year was the first year where there were more new discoveries from archival data than from freshly collected observations. Right? So enormously valuable data. So what's the preservation plan for it? Well, there is one. Both the University of Chicago and Hopkins have received funding to keep to work on preservation, to keep the bits spinning, to work on ways to back them up for the long haul. And that funding extends through 2013. Now, surely, Sloan won't walk away from it, or NSF will step up for it, or somebody will step up for it for another 5 or 10 years. But here's the problem. We can't think 5 to 10 years. We got to think 1,000 years. How do we actually architect a system that's going to last for 1,000 years? Now, the good news is we've seen this picture before. If you look at the current state of digital preservation, lots of repositories, a smattering of aggregation, lots of single points of failure, that looks a lot like what networking used to look like. Right? Every campus was starting to create a connection with their regional network. Right? And what we did was, we came in, and we built a backbone underneath it. We integrated, we replicated, we made sure that we had diversity. So it's a lot like what it did. And in fact, actually, if you think about it, Internet 2, the founding of Internet 2, provides a really, really good roadmap for the problem that we have here. Right? Internet 2 was a research network paid for, owned by and for the academy to fuel discovery. So maybe we need to do the same thing on the back end, owned by and for the academy, to catch discoveries and preserve them for the future. And the landscape looks a lot the same. Lots of one-off solutions. I have to tell you that I think the digital preservation field right now needs another pilot project, like a hole in the head. We're drowning in preservation pilots, all small scale, all trying to solve problems. We're learning a lot from them. We're just not getting closer to an aggregated shared solution. There is emerging aggregation on the access front. People are figuring out that they don't want to run their own repository, even access-oriented repository. The disciplines are building their own repositories. Again, we're seeing aggregation, right? And we're seeing multiple, again, single points of failure. And the trajectory looks a lot like it. So, right, Internet 2 starts by looking at networking. Networking is incredibly complicated. You've got a network stack, right? You've got the physical network. You've got address space layered on top of it. You've got authentication and authorization on top of that. You've got services somewhere way up on the end. So we talk about the network stack. And what Internet 2 did was started by just simply building first the physical layer of the network. Right? And that network, by the way, by today's comparison, was terrible. I think the total capacity of the original Internet, Internet 2, was like 10 gig. And in the third generation network that's just being rolled out, I believe the capacity is 8.8 terabytes. I got it for memory. Okay. Internet 2 people are back there going, yeah, 8.8 terabytes. So it was a crappy network when we rolled it out. By comparison to what was available, it was fabulous. But looking back, it was a crappy network. It's a fabulous network now. And 10 years from now, we're going to look back at it and we're going to say, boy, that was a really crappy network then, right? It's one of these things that moves and it keeps improving, right? And not only that, if you look at what Internet 2 has been doing, Internet 2 has been moving up the stack. So they start by building a physical network. Now we're working on authentication and authorization schemes. So in common is addressing further up the stack. The Net Plus services that Internet 2 has announced are really about delivering services over the network. So as things started to standardize and scale, they moved up the network. We need to do the same thing in preservation. So my point is going to be, we're either going to solve this problem institution by institution at great expense and with little chance of solutions that last, or we're going to solve it together at scale, just like we did for high-performance networks. Right? So what about those single points of failure? Right? Well, here's how do you deal with single points of failure? Well, we're taking a lesson from the space shuttle. When the information systems for the space shuttle were designed, NASA let out a single set of specifications, awarded three contracts to three different vendors, told those vendors they could not use the same operating systems, could not use the same hardware, could not share architectures. And when the space shuttle flew and made automated decisions, it polled those, all three were installed. All three ran on every flight. And when it made automated decisions, it polled those three, and if it didn't get at least two out of three agreeing, then it kicked it up for a human decision. Right? So the lesson from that, right, the point is you want to avoid failure by building in replication diversity. So maybe that's what we need to do, right? Eliminate single points of failure by building in replication diversity. When I talk about replication diversity, most people think about geographic diversity. I mean, we know this geographically. You don't keep your core system in one location. You at least have a backup somewhere. Ideally, you have the service split across two geographic locations, right? We know that earthquakes happen, hurricanes happen, if natural events happen that take one site offline. But we actually have to think about replication across a much more diverse thing than simply geographic location, right? So we need to come in and get replication diversity, and we need to create a sustainable framework at scale that evolves and adapts to new preservation challenges. So here's one of the things that I think is really important. This isn't a technical problem. I mean, there are a lot of technical challenges along the way, but this is not a technical problem. It's an organizational problem, right? It's about organizing capital and organizing requirements and moving together. So the proposal is to create a federated digital preservation network. We call it DPN, DPN, owned by and for the Academy. Critical, owned by and for the Academy. To ensure that the objects and metadata of research are preserved for future generations, are replicated across diverse dimensions, beginning with, you want replication across software architectures, you want replication across organizations. If Sloan decides not to fund it, you don't want Sloan Digital Sky Survey to go away. You want to replicate across geographic regions. Again, we sort of get that. And ultimately, after first launching within the United States, we want to replicate across nations. You don't want any single point of failure, including political failure. With me? Okay, so ensure sustainability and longevity by building a framework that is, that can scale and evolve, just like Internet 2 has scaled and evolved, over time, formats, and organizations. So it is to recognize that preservation is going to be a moving target and build a complex adaptive system that moves with it. Right? And along the way, so here's another thing. So particularly when it comes to text, people say, well, you can't have preservation without access. And I will stipulate that access helps on preservation. Many eyes make digital content safer. Absolutely. But it's also a reality that you're not going to be able to provide access to everything. And it's not just because the publishers won't let you. Your scientists aren't going to let you provide lots of eyeballs to lots of their data, at least not anytime soon, right? So we have to find ways that we guard against the thing we can't have, which is many, many eyes. So DPN is a dark archive, at least starting out. So the way to approach that is to rigorously and continuously audit and verify succession capabilities. So let me try to... This is it conceptually. It's really simple, right? The simple idea is we leverage the aggregation that's already taking place in the access nodes, just like Internet 2 did with the regional networks. And we come in and we build behind it, underneath it, this preservation backbone, right? Where we make sure that we have at least three, and there's nothing magic about that, but at least three different architectures, different organizations, each with a copy that's dark, except for audit and verification purposes, each with a copy, constantly synced, constantly verifying that they can, in fact, ingest the stuff from other repositories. If that repository fails, give it back, right, with all its functionality. If that repository or that organization goes away completely, that the data and the metadata can at least be provide. I think of it as providing web access. You can see the data, you can read the metadata, and you could build a system to do whatever the old system did again, assuming it was all documented well in the metadata. That's a challenge, but assuming it is. Right? So the idea is not that this is the, it is deep insurance is what this is. Right? It's about architecting for the long haul. Right? So the idea is to start with text. We understand text. We actually have pretty good aggregation in text. So, you know, we've got HathiTrust, which is catching all the Google books. There's a consortium that includes North Carolina and North Carolina State, and actually it's got about, about a half a dozen or so to a dozen institutions now that's spinning up what's called AP Trust, which is going to be a shared repository built on Fedora Commons as opposed to HathiTrust architecture, and Stanford sitting out there running their own repository structure, right? So what if we take those three to start with and say, let's start passing information, let's build, let's see if we can, in fact, build this backbone underneath, duplicating, show that we can get the verification, show that we can get the audit in. With me? Make sense? Start with text. By the way, people think text is already solved because we got HathiTrust, or we got Clocks, or we got Portico. Well, actually, unless they're in this kind of relationship, we don't. We've got isolated pockets with non-overlapping, sometimes collections, all dependent upon a single organization or a single technology. DPN wants to bring that together, right? Move to rich media, right? So you could imagine going to C-SPAN, going to Shoah, see whether or not the repository architecture that you need for rich media is different from what you need for text. Our bet is that it's not, but it could be. And then move to large data. Again, may not be much of a difference in what the architecture requires, huge difference in scaling. So, for example, Fedora has been tested against millions of instances. Chronopolis, I believe, has been tested against billions of instances. Those will pale in comparison to some of the data sets we'll get. Still making sense? So DPN's not a software project. It's about designing an ecosystem. It's about designing a complex adaptive system that can change and grow and move. to address new forms of scholarship, and changing formats, and the evolution of software. It's a federation, not a monopoly. So one of the things that people often think is, well, so is DeepIn competing with Portico? Is DeepIn competing with HathiTrust? Is DeepIn competing with Clox Locks? No. DeepIn is actually made possible by those. They're focused on access. They're focused on aggregating content. That enables DeepIn to come in underneath and say, okay, now let's make sure we've got it all backed up properly across this diverse ecosystem. Right? And the primary functions of DeepIn, right? It's not about access. It's about durable access. It's about having the capacity. Should disaster strike, think about it like a seed bank. It's about preserving the work should disaster strike. But disaster not like, you know, one of the things that's hard in a talk like this is it sounds like, yeah, but don't we take insurance policies after this? You can't replace, I mean, if we screw this up, it's gone forever. You can't take out an insurance policy on it, right? If we lose the Sloan Digital Sky Survey data, it's gone forever, right? So the functions of DeepIn are to audit and verify. Make sure that what you've got across the diverse ecosystem, across the diverse repositories are in fact the same things. Provide grant-based, contract-based funding to the replicating nodes, right? So the idea is in DeepIn, you've got the access layer at the top where the aggregation is happening, and things get deposited into what we call replicating nodes. Replicating nodes because each node replicates the content of all the other replicating nodes, right? Or at least replicates it across three different replicating nodes, three different architectures. So you want to always be going with whatever the best technology is. It's sort of like a NOC. They're like a NOC. DeepIn will contract with them to run on whatever the best technology of the day is. And as long as they're doing well on it, great. They keep getting the contract. If they don't, we move the repository somewhere else. Right? It's much like thinking about a network operation system. It's about providing a legal framework for developing and holding succession rights. So in my dream of dreams, Turner Broadcast, Turner Worldwide, own some of the most amazing cultural record of this century in this country, of the last century in this country. It's called films and television. They own the rights to them. They're going to continue to monetize and exploit that forever in their mind. And I'm good with that. I just want to go to them and say, great, but deposit it in DeepIn as a risk management strategy for yourselves, because DeepIn's keeping it dark. But should you ever, and I know you'll never do this, but should you ever lose interest in trying to monetize that content, give the rights to the Academy so that the Academy can go ahead and take responsibility for it. Because one of the things we have right now is no clear transition of who's responsible for preserving what. And in the end, again, it's only the Academy that cares about this. It's only the Academy that's structured to do that. It's also to provide a structure and organization for aligning and leveraging preservation activities and investments. We have to spend our money much more efficiently than we're doing it right now. And, you know, in the early days, it's great to have pilots. We're now at a point, you know, if anything being a CIO has taught me, it is that scale matters a lot in networked environments. And this is fundamentally a networked environment. Can we afford DeepIn? Right? Well, I don't know. So, yes, I mean, the answer is, philosophically, you know we can afford it because we're going to waste it otherwise. We're going to go spend one-offs way more than we will spend if we get together. But how much would it cost? Well, one of the great models that I use is how much did it start? How much did Internet 2 start with? Started with about 15 million. Started with about 15 million. I think this year it passes almost 100 million through its coffers, much of it not from the Academy. But it started with 15 million. Or if you think about it, how much is it going to cost? Unclear. But it feels to me like getting replicating nodes, different architectures talking to each other, passing messages, developing succession rights. Those feel like sort of Kowali-style enterprise projects. Those typically have a burn rate of about $3 or $4 million a year. This is three of them. So pretty soon, $15 million is a pretty good place to start, I think. So at $15 million, the annual cost at startup for DeepIn is 5/10,000ths of a percent of the combined annual research expenditures of the R1 institutions. It is rounding error. And part of what we have to do is recognize that it's rounding error and we can round together, or we can make that number a lot bigger by doing it separately. And more importantly, it should be possible to get grant funding to help with one-time capital expenses and to develop service fees. You have a data management plan. You have to provide long-term access to your data. Well, if that's part of the data management requirement, it sounds a lot like page publication requirements. NSF is actually happy to pay for that. They're happy to pay a service fee that they know what they're getting. What they're not happy to do is to fund ongoing the infrastructure. So if you go with them for the proposal and say, hey, we need to buy a lot of servers, and then we're going to need to refresh them every 10 years and 5 years or whatever, and we're going to have to figure out this. They're not interested in that. They've made it abundantly clear. They'll provide one-time money once, and then it's yours to own. So DPIN is being designed from the beginning with the idea that the Academy actually has to own that basic infrastructure. But we're going to find ways to make sure that we have revenue streams that come from deposit fees, that come from partnerships. Again, much like Internet 2, right? The Academy isn't spending $100 million on Internet 2, but Internet 2 is getting the revenues for it. Does that make sense? We pitched this to the AAU presidents, and this was really key, and we've been pitching it to NSF. It's really a key understanding that it's the Academy saying we got to own it. I mean, we own libraries. We wouldn't think to go right now and say to NSF, help us build libraries, right? We might say, give us some one-time startup, but we know we're going to own them over the long haul. So DPIN benefits, preserve scholarship for future generations. That's the main one, but there are more. It slices, it dices. So ensure that DPIN members continue to have access to the scholarship of the Academy in the event of one or more failures. So understand what DPIN does is it preserves the option of access down the line. It's not like you're going to flip a switch. This is, again, like a seed bank, right? But it gives the Academy and DPIN members the option. Presidents like that because they're thinking competitive advantage. What do my scientists have? How much insurance do I have around my scientists having continued access to the data that they need versus other institutions? It can evolve to include new forms of scholarship and data as they emerge, right? So DPIN basically says, let's solve the things at scale that we understand and we can solve, and let's make sure that as these pilots are happening in new areas with new forms of scholarship that we don't understand, they're happening against the context of DPIN, so that we work along the way as they start to hit scale to bring them in, right? It will help us rationalize our collective investments in preservation efforts and leverage diverse funding sources. We won't all be running to Mellon exclusively saying, please fund this next pilot, right? And Mellon's not going to continue to do that. It'll create a framework against which the Academy can retool publication workflows for a digital world. At some level, I actually think this is, well, the most important is preserving it for future generations, but for the near term, I actually think this is one of the most important things. One of the things that we struggle with is that we understand how workflows work in an analog world. They've evolved, and what I mean by that is, as a professor, other than figuring out how to get my research done and how to get it published, I don't actually have to think about anything else. And that work will wind up in a library preserved, and my intellectual children and grandchildren will continue to be able to have access to it. It's so deeply ingrained that we think it must be the way God or Darwin intended it to be, depending on your preference, right? In the digital world, we don't have a clue how that works. And there's no anchor against which we could actually start building those workflows. So one of the things that DPIN does is it puts an anchor. It says, well, at one end, you at least want the bits that comprise the data and the metadata archived across diverse structures. And we want to know, so we got to figure out, how do I get it in there, right? It is something at scale that forces the Academy to attack against. And importantly, it's something at scale that we control. It's not the whims of a publisher, right? It's not the whims of some other force. And it provides a way of planning campus-based cyber infrastructure so that it efficiently feeds those workflows and preservation efforts. So you know what I sort of think most faculty need They need a workspace. They need a data parking lot. They need a place where they have complete control over who has access, how much is stored there, right? But at some point, their interests move on, and they want to be able to deposit that, hand that off to somebody else, right? DPIN provides a way of thinking about that. So maybe central IT provides the spinning disks, or provides, really it's just stewards of where the disks, where the spinning disks come from. Maybe we get it from the cloud. But central IT is responsible for that. The library is responsible for helping catch the stuff that's going to be held for the long haul, and working with faculty to understand and working to figure out how to winnow. So where are we today? 57 institutions have joined DPIN and collectively provide $1 million in base funding. We're looking to make that a multi-year commitment so that we just have that as sort of a base of operations. Interim leadership team is in place. We've been working with AAU and ARL to develop a permanent governance model. Much like Internet 2, the idea is going to be that this is going to be a governance model that is dominated by presidents. One of the things that's also, I think, different about DPIN is we made the pitch to the presidents from the beginning, right? And we, and when I was talking to AAU, they said, well, why do you want presidents involved in this? Well, for the same reason presidents are involved in Internet too. At some level, the stewardship, in the end, it is one of those university-level stewardship questions, right? Discover, universities exist to discover, teach, preserve. That's at the top of the list. And university presidents actually hold that role. Right? And if they don't endorse that role, the library can't do it. The library can't do this alone. IT can't do this alone. And so we pitched it to them. Michael McRobbie is the president who's working most closely with us on creating this governance structure. We have a program director, a guy named Steve Morales. He's an amazing Energizer bunny. We have five replicating nodes, institutions, different architectures that have agreed to work together to create the proof of concept of the DPIN network, which means swapping bits, verifying, demonstrating that it's possible to repopulate a contributing node if it fails, and also demonstrating that you can get this, what I was talking about, a web view of the data and the metadata in the other architectures in the event that that one went all the way away. Four out of five of those are swapping bits even as we speak. They're exchanging, their messaging is in place right now. They haven't got the audit and verification in, but we're just making sure they're talking to each other. There's a succession rights group that's starting up. Jim Neal from Columbia is going to be leading this group. And it's really trying to figure out, so what do we need in the way of agreements when you deposit into DPIN, right? The idea is you deposit into DPIN, you maintain control. You keep running your access node. You're doing whatever you want. But at some point, when you deposit, so I sometimes, and I know I will come to regret this many times, I describe DPIN as the Roach Motel. Stuff checks in, it doesn't check out, right? So one of the things is when you deposit in DPIN, you don't get to come back and say later, oh, wait, I don't really think I like that anymore. History has changed and we don't look so good in that. I want to take it out. You don't have that option, right? So figuring out what the succession rights are. We're in discussions with NSF, IMLS, Library of Congress, NIST, et al. About funding models. And again, so far those conversations are pretty positive. They want the kind of aggregation and combined movement that they see. They don't want to hit 1,000. And we're engaging with data communities pretty opportunistically. You know, one of the things that is true is that the data communities are, you know, disciplines are into themselves, and they have repositories. And actually, so in the library world, the hardest thing was convincing people that we still needed more insurance around text because people had already gotten HathiTrust and dark versus light. That was a big issue. That is not going to be the issue with the scientists. The issue with the scientists is whether they, in fact, need it. Because for many of them, the horizon is 5 years, 10 years, it's the next grant. And somebody should be worrying about it, but they're not necessarily doing it. So I think that's actually going to be the harder pitch. And there's a website under construction. The risks that we have are inertia, the perfect. So again, stipulate what we roll out the first time. It's going to look crappy retrospectively, but it's better than what we're going to have right now. Another study, our own sheer weight. So one of the things that's hard is once you have 57 institutions and you know, potentially growing, is how do you continue to move nimbly without moving with full participant? How do you make sure that the willing and the able are driving it, not just the willing or the able? We need that combination. So Digital Preservation Network, coming soon, is dpn.org, dpn.org. If you have questions, we've got time for questions now. But if you have questions afterwards, you can feel free to email me, but also Steve Morales is the program director, and he can tell you way more than I can. So what do you think? Yeah, but what do you think about the idea?
James, I have one for you. Uh-huh. I assume you want us to use the mics. You keep saying doing it at scale. And there, all your drawings, there's technology in those drawings. The scale of those keep growing. The worry is that the scale of the data that we're thinking about is growing much, much faster.
Right.
And is deep in a framework for thinking about what do we keep, what do we throw away.
So my short answer is I don't see a better alternative. If we don't have something that is from the beginning committed, that recognizes that scale is going to be an issue, that from the beginning is designing with scale in mind, that is again aggregating both our capacities and our demand, we'll never get there. I mean, nothing is going to stop. If DPN doesn't exist, it's not going to stop the explosion of data. It's just going to now mean that there's really absolutely nothing that you can hope to. The other thing that is going to be interesting is to figure out what, you know, there's going to be a... At first, I was trying to think about how do you fund DPN in ways that doesn't rely upon deposit fees. Deposit fees are actually a feature, not a bug. Because resource commitments force people to be intentional about what they're going to do. If DPN is just the attic, then it won't work, right? DPN's got to be about those things. It's the reason why it's got to be a deep partnership with librarians and with disciplines. It's about winnowing. You know, at some level, it's about winnowing down. What are the things that you're going to keep for the long haul? And how do we? And it's always going to be a guess. What we were managed to preserve today was somebody's guess or good fortune or luck. Really, one of the ways that I think about it is DPN is trying to bias those somewhat random processes in a favorable direction to bring a little more intentionality to it.
So, James, what do you see as the major barriers right now that you're going to have to get past, and what's a rough timeline?
So I think the major barrier is the major barrier we all face in internet time. So when this was presented at ARL and at CNI, actually I did a presentation of this at CNI, and somebody walked up to me and said, man, this is the hot project in the library community. This is the rock. Last year it was DPLA, right? Digital Public Library of America. But this year it's you guys, and that's a problem. Because, you know, whether or not you can keep the attention span of this diverse community focused on a problem that's very hard and going to do it. So it's one of the reasons why we're actually not focusing a lot on publicity right now, and we're focusing on getting these replicating nodes going, because I believe we have to be able to go back to CNI actually at the midterms, right? It's like an election. We got midterms coming up. CNI is in a month. We actually have to be able to go in and say, so what's changed between now and the last time? Because if we just stay at the rhetoric of, isn't this really important and shouldn't we all rally the troops, we'll lose it. So momentum is the biggest threat.
Hi, I have a question from the online audience.
Yep.
And the question is, how can small liberal arts schools facing many of the same challenges as Research One institutions in the area of digital repositories contribute in a meaningful way to a project such as DPN?
Right. So in a different set of talks, like on the future of higher education, where we're all going, I really believe we are about to go into an age of extreme differentiation. That in higher education right now, we do ourselves a disservice by underestimating our differences. We need to actually embrace our differences. So every school has some collection that only they have. So maybe the focus is on how do you get that piece of the collection into DPIN, right? It's about finding where we have differences and bringing those in. It's not about, well, there's only one category of membership. And again, I would say Internet 2 is a great example. Internet 2 has 200 members. By extension, it has thousands of members, and they perform different functions. It is a big tent.
My turn. James, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your comparison of a replicating node to a NOC, because you made the important point that DPIN is not a technology initiative primarily. It's a social contract, right? And you said that one of its primary roles is verification and auditing of the replicating nodes, which have a life of their own outside of DPIN, if I've
sorry,
got that.
Which way?
They have a life, the replicating nodes have a life of their own outside of DPIN. They already exist. You're bringing them together and having them replicate each other. So the question I have is, you know, auditing and verifying a preservation archive is a lot different than auditing a NOC. You know, we have to test things that we don't know how to test yet, like century-long viability of content. So how are you going to approach that? We haven't figured it out now, and it seems like a critical part of what you're proposing as the DPIN vision.
Right. So there are a couple of different responses. A NOC does involve lots of technical problems, lots of technical decisions. Replicating nodes do too. The organizational principle is actually the organizing principle of Internet 2 as a federation and a governance with a mission and a clear alignment around things. And that's DPIN's going to have all of that, right? But then there's, so, you know, my answer is frustrated. It's hard. There are things we haven't figured out. We don't even know yet in terms of thinking about centuries preservation how to do it. But we didn't know how to do most of the Internet a decade ago. So my point is we bring together and we move informed with each other. Again, that's why you want the diversity. So Stanford's going to pursue one strategy. HathiTrust is going to pursue another strategy. And all we want to do is to make sure that we're keeping them connected and that it's not just audit and verify as a passive when people think about, oh, the auditors are coming in. We have to have that level of audit. But there's also just audit and verification that the file that you just sent me and that I sent you are still the same files and the metadata are there and I can bring it into my system if I need to ultimately. Right? That's when I talk about audit and verification. That's what I'm doing. While the broader problem of digital preservation for the long haul, file format migration, how do you preserve an interactive website built in a particular OS right now? I don't know. So DPIN starts with the principle, let's solve the thing we can solve at scale now so that we don't keep solving that one, right, resolving it, so that we can move up the stack. So I'm optimistic about our combined chances and no clue how we're going to get there. Okay? Thank you very much.